Ecco, gli amici di Riccardo Tesi, Banda Italiana, Turchese dal loro disco Madre Perla, il disco precedente al maggio, quello che hanno presentato quest'anno. Allora, ora purtroppo devo finire, devo andare via, ma prima vi faccio capire che cosa ho messo in onda. La Sedon Salvadi, che sono di Udine, credo, comunque del Friuli. Andrea Del Favero, un grande fisarmonicista, è una delle persone di questo gruppo, e questo viene da un disco del 2003, Il Gris e la Mosche. Poi invece cosa ho fatto sentire? Adesso non mi ricordo. Va bene, non è importante. Ci sentiamo la settimana prossima. Vi dico che io sarò qui per altre 2 settimane, poi verrà invece a fare il mio programma un amico, Valerio, che è qui con me in studio, che non so, non sta parlando, però eccolo.
Ciao.
Ciao, quindi Valerio sarà la nuova voce, diciamo, di quest'ora di musica italiana da settembre. Ti ringrazio.
Prego.
Ok. E allora vi lascio invece con un po' di pubblicità interessanti e importanti, e dopodiché c'è Radio Free Thinker, una edizione che parla del virus Ebola che sta rovinando l'Africa in questo momento. Ok, ciao a tutti, ci vediamo, ci sentiamo la settimana prossima. Ciao, ciao.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dantry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotus Land Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to citr.ca.
You know, old girl, sometimes I think you're probably the finest ship ever to have sailed the Vortex.
Oh, I know, Doctor. This is the end of the world news.
So now we know.
Now we know for sure.
But why are they?
I'm waiting for you.
Indeed we are, Doctor. Thursday mornings from 8 to 10 a.m.
It's the Ebola Virus Bias Edition of Radio Freethinker. This week, Ebola, end of the world, the taxman's chill, and cognitive biases, or why you make so many bad choices. Let's begin episode 262.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about the end of the world, or one might think, based on the recent news stories about the Ebola. I say the Ebola because it's not really about the ongoing tragedy in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, and now Nigeria seems to be added to this list. No, when it was in Africa affecting people there, killing people there, it was just the Ebola virus. Worthy of note on page 3, maybe a filler section on the National. That all changed, of course, when two white folk from the U.S. contracted the disease and were shipped to the U.S. for treatment. Suddenly it was front page, and lots of airtime on mainstream media circuits. I realized that it had finally hit the populace when I heard someone at work state, straight-faced, that they heard it was a CIA plot. Oh, yes. And when Fox News, of course, started blaming Obama for the Ebola. Of course, when it involves, quote, our people, and that is now on the shores, as in America, well, maybe we should forgive the hysteria. Of course, they only count as our people, in Canada at least, if you think of white folk as our people. But more interesting is the idea that Ebola has arrived in the USA. This is true in the sense that they are in US hospitals, but it's not like they caught it here. It's no more landed on our shores than pandas did last year. It's also an interesting side note that as it has been running its course in Africa, everyone was like, well, there is no cure, no treatment. Just keep them hydrated and comfortable as possible and hope for the best. Yet two Yanks get sick, and suddenly there's a drug that can stop it in its tracks. Okay, there are a lot of reasonable expectations for how we react, the experimental treatments and all that. And I'm not here to expose either hypocrisy or conspiracy. No, it seems that with all that is being said about Ebola, there's been a notable absence of real information. Should we be running for the hills? Is this the end of life as we know it? Let's start with, what is Ebola? Well, its full name is Ebola hemorrhagic fever. And like its name, it causes a fever. It first appeared near the river Ebola. And well, hemorrhagic means to bleed. So it's a bleeding disease. That is, as it takes over the body's cells, it overruns the immune system, generally making hay. And here I quote, it undermines vascular integrity. That is, the body loses the ability to heal cellular damage. Ebola causes cellular damage by using cell membranes to form virion buds, think baby viruses, and thus you start to ooze blood from your orifice, yes, all of them, as well as increasing the risk of tearing the skin and causing even more bleeding. Ebola is transmitted by, quote, blood and bodily fluids. Funny, they all talk about blood as though it were something other than a bodily fluid. But anyway, if you shake someone's hand or you just talk to them, no worries. However, if you kiss or come in contact with said fluids, well, no good news for you. Remember, the virus wants to spread. To help in this task, much to the detriment of the patient, Ebola causes violent vomiting and diarrhea, making it much easier, if not a lot more repellent, to come into contact with those bodily fluids. Ebola is a member of the Filoviridae family and related to the Marburg viruses. These viruses have as one of its defining characteristics, it tries to kill people. Well, primates, and we're primates. Ebola has several types that we know of, or at least that are responsible for major outbreaks. Sebov, one of the first seen in 1976, strikes Sudan and has also been seen in Uganda. BDBV, also seen in Uganda. And lastly, and most prevalent, is Zebov, or Zaire strain, which is the current flavor ravaging Africa right now. There have been 28 outbreaks of Ebola since its first discovery in 1976, resulting in 1,700 deaths, prior, of course, to the current outbreak. Although it was mainly done its damage in Africa, both Italy and the U.S. had outbreaks, although in those places, only monkeys died, which were imported from the Philippines, another place where Ebola has killed off monkeys, but is yet to be seen in people. Well, so far, it's been reported that about 2,000 people have been infected. About half of them have already died. A typical mortality rate of Ebola is about 85%, so it's likely the death toll will rise. To get an idea of the impact of the latest outbreak, I should point out that currently, more people have been infected by Ebola than all other outbreaks combined. Holy crap! Run for the hills! It's the end of the world! Well, no. Don't panic. Relax. As I said, it's actually very difficult to be infected. Yes, when it first appears, there's a spike in the number of cases. But simple isolation is often enough to end the outbreak. That is why most of the previous outbreaks have body counts usually well under 100. Now you might say, well, Don, you said don't panic and followed up with saying something like, has killed more than ever before. Well, that may make us want to panic. Has the virus mutated? No, the strain of Ebola is the same that has reoccurred a dozen times before. So it's not the virus that has changed. But previous outbreaks had occurred in relatively isolated communities that could be easily quarantined and allow the virus to run its course. You see, another important factor in determining how an infection will spread is to know its natural host. In this case, it's the fruit bat. It's common practice for people to eat what they call bushmeat, but traditionally, this was a practice of the hill people, so to speak, not city folk. But the current outbreak has occurred in vastly more densely populated areas with a higher degree of interconnectivity. That is, what might have been a village treat has found its way into the city markets. On an obvious point, the possibility of it being spread increases with population density, so it spreads more quickly than previous outbreaks. This leads to a feedback loop. That is, the larger the area infected, the more spread out where the healthcare workers and their resources are needed to attack the outbreak. So instead of one village or one hospital to deal with it, you are now dealing with three countries, many cities, and countless medical facilities. As staff become spread out, they get tired, make more mistakes, leading to a greater spread, and another feedback loop happens. The more the doctors and nurses get infected, reducing the number of people able to deal with the outbreak, further thinning out the resources available to attack the epidemic. It is likely these feedback loops have caused the standard course of the disease to change. In May 18th of this year, the WHO predicted that the outbreak would be ended by the 22nd. Instead, you got a rebound and a new spike happening 2 months later. There were other factors that have allowed this pathogen to have greater impact than before. First, places like the Congo and Uganda have suffered several outbreaks. The people know what to expect and how to react. This is the first time Ebola has hit this part of Africa. This means that, for starters, people are reticent to stop traditional burial practices that include washing the body and kissing it as sort of a spiritual send-off. Both of these factors only help spread the disease. This lack of historical knowledge also leads to the bizarre, well maybe being unkind, maybe not so bizarre effect that where you have family members hiding sick relatives for fear the, quote, spacemen might get them. You see, the early symptoms of Ebola are like a mild flu. So from their perspective, auntie gets a little sick, then these not African people dressed up in these white spacesuit type things take her away, and then they're told she's dead. It's not a stretch to imagine to think that the space people killed her. Ergo, next time you hide your relative in order to save them. Coupled with a society that is very distrustful of its government, corruption is ripe, there's been civil and guerrilla wars, you take everything the, quote, authorities say with a grain of salt. Here in Canada, if a government official knocked on your door and said there was a health emergency and could you do X, Y, and Z, well, you'd likely comply. Not in this part of Africa, where distrust in government is high, and not without reason. Local tensions have gotten so bad, there are some cities where there are riots, where people have tried to burn down the hospital to, quote, free their loved ones. It has only been the efforts of police and other military officers that have kept this thing in check. Just the other day, all three nations mobilized their military to impose quarantines. They have closed their borders and are aggressively dealing with this sort of secondary plague, fear. We should also remember that the new potential hotspot for Ebola is Nigeria, with a population almost 10 times that of the combined current three nations under attack. Nigeria is also the place where polio found safe harbor as Muslim imams declared polio vaccination a Western plot to kill Muslims. What are they going to do if Ebola breaks out in strength there? So to return to the question, should we be worried? No, well at least not here. If I was in Africa, maybe, but not here. As you may have heard in the news, the moment a suspected case is found in Toronto, New York, what have you, they are quickly rushed to quarantine. A series of tests are quickly conducted. And so far in all cases, no Ebola was found. But if there was Ebola found, treatment and containment procedures would immediately begun. Relative to the infected countries, our healthcare system is extremely robust and capable. Other factors that are hindering the decline of Ebola in Africa. We also have no natural reservoir. So the only way to get it is via a traveler. And again, because it's not easily transmitted, you're not going to get the primetime TV plot where someone on the plane is infected but unaware they are. You would know it if you were at least contaminated, as the transfer of bodily fluids, at least in this case, is frowned upon as communal activity. So not much to worry about. If you really want to worry, well, there are a lot more deadly viruses out there. Yes, 2,000 seems like a lot, but when you compare that to the measles, which kills almost 200,000 a year, or influenza at 500,000 a year, and of course the granddaddy of all, HIV, which indirectly kills over 1 million people a year, it doesn't seem that bad. And a bit of trivia. The disease most likely to kill you once symptoms arise? A disease that kills 55,000 people a year? Rabies, which has an almost 100% fatality rate once you start experiencing symptoms. That said, it's also one of the most treatable, at least in the Western world, with a series of vaccinations. These vaccinations are almost always given, even if there's a slight chance that you may have been infected, because treating rabies before it's symptomatic gives you an almost 100% survival rate. And of course, the most likely candidate to be the big pandemic to wipe out humanity is the bird flu or influenza. At the end of the Great War, the Spanish flu infected 500 million people, or 1 in 3, and likely killed more than 75 million people. And it's on that cheery note that we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back after this.
She'll make a lovely doll after I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless.
Spider-Man! He's melting!
It's too hot. It's too hot. Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it off.
Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable? Turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power Science World for over 75 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back. We have joining us today in Radio Freethinker's virtual studio our regular, irregular, and sometime historian Ethan Clough.
Well, Don, great to be back.
This week we're going to discuss about Harper's attack on charities. We talked a few shows back about Harper made special provisions in the budget to give the CRA, that's the Canada Revenue Agency, $8 million to perform special additional audits of nonprofits. This was seen at the time, and we reported here on the show, as a way to intimidate environmental groups that were impeding Harper's plans to market the tar sands and natural gas. These groups, at the time, were labeled as radical money laundering and tantamount to environmental terrorists. This seemed to be a good way for the Harper government to strike back and muzzle these problematic groups. And, well, it seems the current government is very happy with the results. The additional funding given the CRA has increased to $11 million, and it seems the scope has increased. The crux of the CRA audits are to ensure that nonprofits spend 10% or less of their resources on political activity. And take note, resources. So this is not just money, but this includes things like volunteer time, any innumerable things, anything that qualifies as a resource for the nonprofit. The CRA also seems to be in the process of creating a special permanent unit to perform these political investigations. The biggest problem nonprofits have is what qualifies as political activity is actually very ambiguous. To illustrate this point, recently Oxfam has lost its charity status because the CRA stated that providing support for those in poverty was a charitable act, but providing support to prevent people from falling into poverty was activism of a political nature. One of the key roles charities and nonprofits provide society is social activism of underprivileged groups and to create support structures and programs that help prevent social ills. The CRA argument with Oxfam could logically extend that efforts to help those suffering spousal abuse are charitable, but efforts to prevent spousal abuse are political. To reduce this argument to absurdity, it's okay to treat heart disease, but efforts to prevent heart disease is political. It's totally nuts. Although the CRA is an arm-length agency from the government, when the government provides extra money to the tune of millions of dollars to perform these particular audits, the heads of the CRA know without being told what is expected of them, and they or their agency is rewarded with more resources. To reinforce this implied interference and this carrot and stick effect, the CRA has seen its budget actually cut in other areas to the tune of losing 3,000 jobs from the part of the CRA that would track down things like corporate tax fraud. So it seems that Harper is trying to hone what the CRA's real purpose is, not to collect more taxes, not to crack down on fraud, but to be used as a way to muzzle politically inconvenient members of society. The first round of targets were, as already mentioned, environmental groups such as the David Suzuki Foundation. Then entities like the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives were added to the list. Well, the latest round are including groups like PEN, PEN Canada represents more than 1,000 writers and supporters, including Canadian literary luminaries such as Margaret Atwood and Yann Martel, and press for freedom of expression both home and abroad. It's in the area of freedom of expression that it has crossed swords with the Harbour regime, as PEN has spoken out against the muzzling of Canadian scientists and the spying on Canadians revealed by the Snowden leaks. Well, it seems very coincidental that as PEN comments on the current government policy, note it's a policy position and not a political one, that they suddenly come under the review of this special political audit team from the CRA. And it's important to note, as I am sure some people will say, well, if they have nothing to hide, what's the harm? Well, beyond the widespread chill, and in doing my research, it has sparked a severe chill and political correctness in the nonprofit area. But beyond this chill, there are some very real practical problems. Audits are time-consuming and very expensive. PEN, for example, has only 2 employees. Instead of advocating and promoting free speech, they will be spending most of their time collecting documents, labeling expenses, ensuring to classify them as either political or not, and they won't actually have the time to do the social activism they've been intended to do. One group, whose name escapes me right now, who helps with press freedoms in Central America, well, they're being forced to translate all their correspondence with their partners in those countries, which are all Spanish-speaking, into French and English. Not only an onerous task as far as time and effort, but expensive as well. So, Ethan, you did a whole show about this, didn't you? What's your take on this whole issue?
So the CRA, the Canadian Revenue Agency, has recently been going on an audit rampage, if I can use that term, of various nonprofit charities here in Canada. And given the particular charities that they've been focusing on, it has raised a little bit scary question as to the motivations behind these audits. And some of these charities include Amnesty International, the David Suzuki Foundation, various environmental charities, various civil rights and free speech charities. And it has made many think that perhaps the CRA is sort of carrying out a political vendetta against these organizations, which have all been very critical of our current Harper government, which the CRA has flatly denied, of course, but there really isn't a lot of evidence that we can draw from to indicate that they certainly aren't doing this, and we haven't seen them audit any, as we might characterize them, conservative or traditional charities at this point. All we've seen them audit is more left-leaning charities, more environmental charities, more human rights charities. And again, there's really hasn't been a satisfactory explanation from the CRA at this point.
Well, and on top of that, you have this whole thing about how the Harper government has actually allocated extra funds to do exactly this kind of audit on nonprofits. Just for a bit of a historical context, I don't know if you know this off the top of your head, but how onerous has it been in the past for charities to meet these sort of documentary sort of requirements to prove that they are a charity and not some sort of political activist group?
Well, it's interesting. The CRA issues a series of rules and regulations that a charity has to abide by. The key rule in this case is that a charity cannot spend more than 10% of its resources on political activities. And political activities, meaning things like endorsing candidates or talking about a political party's platform, and then it gets a bit grayer as you go. They are strictly forbidden from directly involving themselves in politics. So things that, you know, we would normally associate with like direct lobbying or taking a political stance, that sort of thing is generally forbidden. But the sort of gray area that qualifies political activities in quotation marks is not really defined, nor is resources really defined, because 10% could mean a charity can't spend, say, 10% of their annual budget on a political purpose. But, I mean, imagine if a charity has a warehouse full of volunteers who phone up their donors and say, by the way, don't vote for X politician. I mean, in that case, they haven't spent any resources except for like the electricity bill because they're not paying volunteers. So how does that count as resources?
Well, and doesn't it get grayer because, you know, they, to say vote for or not vote for this particular candidate has one thing, but if you're advocating that we should spend more money to help reduce poverty, that's more of a policy thing than a political thing, but does that qualify?
Well, again, and this is where it gets gray, because indeed, if a political party, let's just say, for instance, that the Liberal Party of Canada was advocating that we chop down 20% of the forests in BC because there might be gold, I don't know, under the forest. Now, an environmental charity can say, well, we don't have an opinion on the Liberal Party per se, but this plan is ludicrous. It's dangerous. It's stupid. It harms the environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, in theory, they should be allowed to say that because the political party's goal is directly related to the cause and mission of the charity in question, which is environmental protection. Now, the question, of course, becomes at what point does this charity cross a line in criticizing that political party's motive? Now, I would argue that that line should be, and I think is beneficial for our democracy, if that line is incredibly far away. But if you look at the examples of the charities that are being audited right now who have criticized our conservative government, it looks like that line is a lot closer than we all, I think, hoped and fear it is.
Besides the increased funding, there aren't any, like, you know, red flags. Like, there's no email or letter that says, hey, Mr. Harper, to the head of the CRA, would you please target these particular groups?
Well, as far as we know, I mean, maybe something WikiLeaks can get onto. But one of the things that I think we all should be aware of, and again, like, you know, let's keep in mind that we don't want to be putting on tinfoil hats every time something bad happens. But if we are looking at sort of the track record of our current government, I think it's really fair to point out that this is a government where senior officials have referred to environmentalists as eco-terrorists. They've referred to people like David Suzuki as radical Canadians. So it's not, I think, going ridiculous levels to suggest that this government is a bit hostile to human rights and environmental charities.
And I don't think it's much of a stretch for the head of the CRA to sit there and say, hey, listen, if I want things to go well for my department, it's best I sort of play ball with the Harper government, because then I will get more resources for my department, my job will be more secure. And, you know, even if there isn't an explicit tit for tat, there is sort of a systemic bias built in by the government's attitude towards the CRA and, more importantly, towards these other groups.
Well, and it could even be, I think, even more sort of insidious than that, in that it could be that the senior leadership of the CRA may not necessarily be compliant with the government's agenda, but they may be tacitly compliant by being overzealous and following the rules. Or, as you say, there could be certain members who say, well, I don't want to lose my job. I want to have a future in politics. I better tote the line. And it can simply be as simple as that, and in ways as innocent as that. The problem is, of course, that they have a lot of authority, a lot of power, and misuses of that, unfortunately, can have drastic effects if a charity loses its status, or in some cases, if they face a severe audit.
I noted that one member of parliament has actually called for a review of the CRA's policy, you know, accusing them of sort of blatant abusing, and that this does seem to be more than just random auditing, that there is directedness. I mean, who knows? Maybe the head of the CRA is a Harperite himself. I mean, that would be more blatant. But what sort of defense, for lack of a better word, have the charity, the sector, done in response to this?
Well, the charity sector is in a...
Actually, before we go there, what has the sector, how have they responded to this, again, what we've sort of termed attack by the CRA on charities in itself? Has it had an effect? Is this chill a real chill?
Well, so to answer the second question there, Don, there was a research paper that was done by a grad student regarding sort of the charity sector and how these audits are impacting it. And he concluded that through interviews, confidential interviews with charity leaders, that there is indeed an advocacy chill, and that many organizations feel that if they speak out, they will risk drawing the ire of the CRA and are intentionally silencing themselves. Now, they're anonymous, we can't really verify that, but it is something to think about. Now, with regards to how the sector is responding to this, every charity responds the same way to the CRA. They comply. They don't try to fight it. They don't try to hide anything because they don't have anything to hide. So they cooperate, they open their books, and they go through the process. Most charities have this kind of relationship, and it's beneficial because the CRA needs to do its job, and the charities have to be compliant, otherwise they risk losing their status. And, you know, it's about working together to make sure that the donor is protected, that the funds are protected, and that the constituents of the charity are being respected. Now, the problem, of course, is that these severe audits, they are a significant drain on the charity's resources. So what charities want, and indeed what I think all the donors and people in the sector would want, is that the CRA to be very careful and to be absolutely sure that when they do an audit in this case, they have reasonable grounds for investigating that charity. Because again, it's resources that the charity has to spend. They have to probably bring on temporary staff. They have to devote time away from their mission and their cause and start spending resources on going through boxes and boxes of paperwork from 3 years ago, trying to determine, you know, was that business lunch a business expense, or was that, you know, not a business expense? And again, it just takes up time and resources away from the charity doing other things.
And not to mention taking time and resources away from the CRA from getting what I would call, quote, perhaps more obvious fraud from corporations or people or such things. But to return to my first question then, how has the sector responded to this? Like, is there a rallying? Is there some pushback from them? Or have they just been completely squashed by this?
Well, many of the smaller charities don't really have an option in this case. They sort of have to follow the rules and keep quiet. Now, there has been growing complaints, issues, concerns. I mean, this issue keeps coming up every week in the newspapers. We hear about some new charity or some new scandal related to the CRA. Many charities have been taking their concerns to Imagine Canada, which is sort of a secondary oversight organization in Canada. Imagine Canada basically reviews charities of their own accord. Many charities voluntarily provide them with their annual budgets, their mission statements, and it's a way for donors to sort of look at the charity from behind the scenes and look at how they're rated and how they spend their resources. So Imagine Canada has kind of become like a secondary advocacy group for charities. And they have been, I think, working in overdrive, trying to figure out how to work with the CRA and try to understand what are the requirements that are being asked of charities and how can they comply with them. Now, the Imagine Canada has been significantly busy with another major problem, which is the new anti-spam legislation here in Canada, which imposed very, very strict regulations on how you can contact donors, how you can contact people on your mailing list, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of charities have absolutely no idea how to navigate these new rules. And so Imagine Canada has been working very hard to sort of get clarification on that. So that's sort of a separate issue related to nonprofits in Canada right now.
And just to make it clear, Imagine Canada is not or is a government agency?
I think that there's probably some kind of crossover there. I'm not exactly sure to what extent that crossover is.
I've also heard that some of them are some of the more major ones, such as the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, are actually contemplating a charter of rights challenge to this, that it's somehow abrogating the rights of free speech.
Well, and they may have a case in that. One of the things that I talked about on last episode of The Sector was kind of comparing how the CRA and the IRS are sort of dealing with the same problem. And the IRS actually sort of put the question to the American charity sector. And universally, across political boundaries, they replied that we do not want our free speech limited by the notion of a political prohibition. And this was something that conservative and liberal charities in America universally agreed on, saying that free speech is more important to us than the possibility of a conservative or a liberal charity doing political advocacy. And I think that's really interesting. And that's something that the Canadian charitable sector may look at and indeed may consider in terms of legal recourse if the situation gets worse.
So to sort of wrap this up then, what can our listeners do? What's the next step in this particular arena?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, this is an important issue, and I think that all of our listeners out there, they should make it known to their local members of parliament, their local senators, that this is something that they're concerned about, that they value free speech more than they value the possibility that a charity is spending 11% of their resources on political advocacy. And again, like, you know, we've often been critical of religious-based organizations or conservative organizations that spend a lot of time advocating politically. I mean, look at the Fraser Institute. All they do is political advocacy. But I'm not comfortable with the idea of shutting them down for that reason. I think that a more valid option is to engage them on their own terms and engage them on the political arena and have organizations like the BC Civil Liberties Association or the Center for Policy Alternatives produce their own quality reports and advocacy, and let that play out in the sort of free market of ideas, as opposed to being like, okay, well, this is currently unpopular, so we're going to censor it. I think that that's the wrong approach.
I think you're right. I think especially with regards to policy debates, the more speech, the more better.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're going to be going for a bit of a break. Talk to you in a bit.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
Cognitive biases are why you get everything wrong. We think we have free will, a topic often broached on the show. Our loyal listeners know that I personally believe that I experience a sense of choice while simultaneously being forced logically to deny its existence. Well, in that then, I thought we should focus on how, even if we thought we were in control, that mechanism is often sidetracked by biases of thought. Just so we understand what we're talking about, a bias can simply be described as an inequality or unfairness for something, be it negative or positive. Cognitive bias is well described by Rational Wiki. It is, and I shall quote here, an inherent thinking error that humans make in processing information. So if I contradict myself and assume we have free will, knowledge of this bias can help us counteract and accommodate them so as to minimize their effect, or so we would wish. So let's start off with the effect heuristic. Okay, to understand this one, I must first ask a question. What is the difference between affect with an A and effect with a E? Well, no, I'll give you a minute. Okay, I'm sure most of you have Googled it by now. Effect is akin to the word result, or caused X. To use a classic example, the effect of the earthquake was to shake the ground. Affect is more to influence or to change X. the earthquake affected the city, which had the effect of shaking the ground. Another way to look at it, the affect with an A is the agent of change, while effect with an E is the change itself. So let us return. The effect bias. Put simply, the way we feel at a particular time will affect or filter the way we interpret the world. The standard example, never shop on an empty stomach. You will buy more and less healthy foods than if you ate first. The effect, with an E, has been tested. In one of many experiments, a set of words were scrolled across the screen so fast that our conscious brain couldn't recognize them. Then the subject was asked to pick as many words as they could from a list that they thought they had seen. Remember, the words were flashed fast enough that our subconscious to, quote, see them, but not long enough for them to actually be registered by the conscious mind. The brain's a wonderful thing, isn't it? Sorry. So they were asked to pick out what they thought were the words that were flashed. If the subject was hungry, they would consistently pick out food words while missing the non-food words. This worked for drinks as well if the subject was thirsty. In subjects in the control group, there was no particular bias. Word types or groups were perceived randomly. So, what seems to be in effect here is that our feelings or state of being will act as a filter on how we interpret the world. This becomes important to us skeptics when we are examining a question. Our feelings may be involved, in this case hunger, need to be accepted. Well, being aware of how we feel is not only affecting us in the way we weigh evidence, but in what we see as evidence, that we can be blinded by our state of mind. Next up, confirmation bias. This is one that often comes up when we skeptics debunk psychics or other charlatans. It also arises when we have the kind of debate with someone of a different opinion. What is confirmation bias? It is our tendency to listen only to information that confirms our preconceptions. If I may point out a disturbing but often heard example, whenever there's a notable cold day, you get all the climate deniers say, look, this proves that global warming is a myth, while ignoring all the evidence that supports climate change. A relative of confirmation bias is the observer expectancy effect. This bias is where our expectations unconsciously influence how we perceive an outcome. Although much of confirmation bias is willful, or at least at some level under our control, this effect is not. An example of this might be if you were investigating a prospective employee and you discovered they have a criminal record. As much as you might try, this knowledge will affect the way you interviewed this person because you have, we all have, a set of preconceived expectations about them. This comes up most often in the skeptic community in scientific experiments. This is why we have what is called the double-blind experiment, so that if a doctor is injecting an experimental drug, neither he nor the patient knows if the needle is filled with a drug or a placebo. You might say, well, you could understand not telling the patient. We all know about the placebo effect, and perhaps even more relevant than the nocebo effect, so a knowing patient could affect the trial. But why the doctor? Well, the doctor may have a tell, as gamblers would say. So even assuming the doctor consciously says nothing, there may be something in their body language, emotion, or something that will affect how the patient interprets the treatment, maybe also affecting how the doctor applies the treatment. If the doctor knows the needle is the real drug, they may take extra care to ensure it is injected into the vein. Well, if a placebo, they may not care at all. That could affect the effectiveness of the treatment and thus the trial. You may have noticed that the biases so far that we have been looking at have been alternating between first letter vowel, first letter consonant. So you just know this one's going to be a consonant-fronted bias. So would you be surprised if the next bias is called clustering illusion? Well, it really should have. This bias is our tendency to see patterns in random events. We have evolved to see patterns to such a degree that we often see them where they don't exist. A common refrain is that it's better to run away from a rock by mistake than not to from a lion and die. We experience this most often in our world, and I'm assuming most of us do not live in neighborhoods frequented by lions or other such predatory carnivores, as it is the foundation of most gambling fallacies. If you're at the roulette table and there have been five red numbers in a row, you think that red is hot and bet on red because, well, it's on a run. Well, the logic is weak, but our cognitive biases seize a pattern, and we want to follow it. Of course, we can use another and just as the logical gambling fallacy and say, well, there have been a lot of reds, so black is due to come up next. Different pattern, same evidence, opposite conclusions, and all based on our faulty cognition. Another core element to human evolution is our social nature. We have innate desires to belong to the group, however you define that. This can create what they call conformity bias. This is a tendency of people to conform to other people. It is so powerful that it may lead people to do the ridiculous. One experiment has one subject group with several fake participants. That is, the fake ones were actually in and part of the experiment. Well, they listened to a group of four musical notes. Listen here. Then they were asked which had the highest pitch. Note, the possible confounding issues like does the subject understand things like pitch or what's the difference between high and low note were addressed by having these subjects be music students. Anyway, they asked the group, one person at a time, with the whole group present, which was the highest tone. They asked each fake participant who stated that tone number two was highest. The real subject was always left to last. As it turned out, 75% of the time, 3 out of 4, the real subject would conform to the group and give the obviously wrong answer. One researcher noted, quote, that we have found the tendency to conform in our society so strong that reasonably intelligent and well-meaning young people will be willing to call white as black is a matter of concern, that it raises questions about the way our education system works and about the values that guide our conduct. Another bias, the curse of knowledge. This is one I suffer with every day of my life. You have no idea, none of you, how hard it is to be as smart as me, to know as much as I do, and try and live in this land of plebes? Okay, yes, my modesty forgives me to continue, but it's a true effect. What is it? Well, put simply, most of us, sorry, not you, Dave, we'll find ourselves in situations where our understandings of an event, a subject, what have you, is sufficiently greater that we are unable to conceive that others do not know this or that, that you assume everyone must know. To get all culturally relevant, for those of you who watch Big Bang Theory, we see this effect whenever Sheldon is baffled by Penny, who cannot understand the basics of quantum theory. He just has no frame of reference to converse with her, and is baffled she lacks even the basics on the topic. Most of us could probably understand that, but our curse of knowledge likely lies somewhere else. Just to show knowledge is a relative thing, you get the exact same effect, but in reverse, whenever Penny discusses things in the social realm, like popular music. Sheldon's left in the dark. This often leads to too much yelling in debates as people talk past each other, not being able to literally understand how the other could be so stupid. This, though, can be one of the easiest, at least in theory, to adapt, and why many progressive movements advocate for education over action, because action without context or knowledge will always hit a brick wall. In the course of my work, I am often confronted with people who do not have the technical knowledge I do. Being modestly aware of this bias, thank you, Mom and Dad, I have learned to adapt my language and to be creative. I try to employ cross-knowledge analogies to help people understand things that are beyond their current level of understanding. Of course, this does require a willingness of all concerned, aptitude on both sides, and, well, a lot of luck. Easier said than done. Directly related to what I would also call the knowledge bias is the availability heuristic. This is where we tend to overestimate the importance of information that is directly available to us. This is often the foundation of anecdotal evidence. I may know, abstractly, that there are lots of studies showing smoking to be fatal, but I have direct knowledge of my Uncle Phil, who smoked 3 packs a day, and he lived to be 100. So how bad could smoking really be? The fact the evidence of Uncle Phil is directly available, well, that will at least subconsciously have greater weight than the real evidence of scientific studies that are only indirectly available to me. We see this one arising so many times in the alt-med or practitioners of woo, where you hear so many times, I don't care about your study. I met this person, and they swear by Compound X. It is also easier for us to think people we have never met are part of some conspiracy than people we've talked to and gotten to know are wrong. This is part of the conformity bias at work. Next on the list is yet another one of the curses of my existence, the halo effect. This is also known as the Steve Jobs effect, if I may once again be culturally relative. We see this effect when we find a person who has a positive attribute in one area, something that has raised them to prominence as a great person. Well, we then assume that everything about that person is great and positive. We see this a lot in movie stars. So for example, for some odd reason, Steve Jobs is credited for creating the iPhone. People then assume that he is, quote, smart, or, and I dare say some people have used this adjective, genius. Well, if he's good enough to create the iPhone, everything he espouses must be equally great. People may not know this, but Steve Jobs, at least for a time, was a fruitarian. That is, he only ate fruit because of, I don't know, nature or something. This diet then became a fad because people assumed Steve Jobs was wise in all things, while ignoring the fact that he has no training as a nutritionist, no special knowledge of biology. It also likely hastened his death because it was all bunk. But the halo effect means that everything he proclaimed was gospel to his loyal and delusional followers. Oh yes, Jesus was the same. Do unto others? Good idea. Slave, obey your master? Not so good. Okay, let's shift gears here and return to the illusion of free will by moving to the ideomotor effect. One can simply call this an unconscious physical reaction, like when we start shedding tears during a sad movie. But in the skeptic community, it's both creepier and more amazing than that. Most skeptics heard of the ideomotor effect when debunking water dowsing, or maybe automatic writing or the Ouija board. In this context, again, completely subconsciously but very real, the subject will, for example, cause through microconstrictions of their hand, again, unbeknownst to them, cause the dowsing rods to cross. Because it's unconscious, to the dowser, it's an external and very real superpower. However, whenever this ability has been scientifically tested, that double-blind study thing already mentioned, the effect is found to be completely internally sourced, and no powers, be they super or not, can find water this way. I should point out that most people who believe this do so honestly. This effect is akin to a physical manifestation of an optical illusion. Even when we know it's not real, it still feels real. Well, it was not my intent to use these biases to take the piss out of free will, but let's give it another kick. Another bias we have is the illusion of control. This is our tendency to overestimate our ability to control events. Like when you have a fan wear a particular sports shirt to the game because it's their, quote, lucky shirt, and the team always wins when they wear it to the game, which is likely in itself selection bias. But we already know about that one. This bias can also be seen played out when people pray to a deity or plead to the universe that if only a certain event occurs, they will do anything in gratitude. The act will change nothing, but as a species, it does provide us at least with some form of solace. This can be dangerous in the same way that alt-med can be. If we convince ourselves that we have some special agency, we may act in a harmful manner. For example, I may be convinced it is only if I give away everything I own to that TV evangelicist that my cancer will be cured. You start thinking positive thoughts because they're supposed to drive out negative energy. And negative energy, everyone knows, I'm winking here, folks, everyone knows, causes every ailment known to man and woman as well. Or simply, you're in line at the grocery store and late for work. You find yourself, in your mind, repeatedly saying, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, as though this will actually increase other speeds. Of course, some biases have adaptive use. For example, we have a negative bias. This is our tendency to put more emphasis or give greater weight to negative experiences than positive ones. A classic example, we hear of one plane crash and on the weight of that evidence swear never to get into a plane again, somehow ignoring or giving less importance to the thousands of flights each day that had no negative event. This is very much related to our pattern recognition bias already discussed. Where most psychologists argue it's actually an evolutionary adaptation. It's better to avoid all blue frogs because one may make us sick than to eat them and find that one poisonous one that will actually kill us. For those who don't know, blue is one of those universal colors in nature that says, I'm dangerous, stay away. Another bias I experience every day in my professional life is post-purchase or post-hoc rationalization. This happens when contemplating a purchase. Should I buy Apple or Microsoft? And once having made that decision, any debate about the value of one over the other is biased by the need to defend our choice. For example, you're a musician and you buy an Apple PC. Then a debate arises over which program is best for audio editing. Well, consciously or not, you will likely bias Apple-based programs because to not do so would imply that you made a bad choice. And no one likes to admit they were wrong and that Windows is a superior operating system. And yes, for those of you who know what my rent-paying job is, I am exemplifying this point in this example. Not all biases are bad. One that can be very useful in our daily life is priming. Priming is where, if you introduce an idea, you're more likely to identify related ideas. So in one experiment, a group of subjects were given a word test, something like match the word to the definition. The subjects were given words in the test that were positive, like happy, fun, pleasure. Another group were given negative words, such as pain, sadness, and death. And of course, there was a control group that would give you neutral words like water, plane, and cow. The subjects were then asked to write an account of an incident or event they wanted. It was found that those with positive words wrote positive stories, negative with negative stories, and the control group wrote about our alien overlords. Priming can also be used to set a context for a discussion. It's also known as the anchoring effect, where people are overly reliant on the first piece of information they hear. This is often used in retail, where you have a salesperson tell you that the price of the article you are purchasing is $1,000, but then say you can have it for $800. In spite of yourself, whatever negotiation happens next, the context is relative to the original $1,000. If you started out by saying that you're willing to pay $600, then the salesperson is forced to work within your context, and much more money is saved.